I'm Justin Lokitz, and this is the Design Shit Podcast, your weekly design guide packed with actionable insights, expert interviews, and bold ideas to help designers at every level lead with clarity, influence change, and shape what's next. In this episode, I sit down with my longtime friend, Nick Coffin, the evidence-obsessed strategist and design leader who's been future-proofing design for decades. From advising giants like Electronic Arts, Genentech, Airbnb, and Adobe, to teaching data literacy to CCA's design MBA program, Nick has one mission: arm design teams with the AI fluency and hard metrics they need to stay indispensable. Keep listening to hear how he's using self-assessment tools at retrain.gage.io to smash adoption barriers, why direction beats deliverables in an algorithmic world, and what every design leader must master before the next disruption hits. And remember to subscribe to the show and the Design Shift newsletter if you enjoyed this episode. Thanks. Well, here we are again, and welcome to Design Shift. Today, I am sitting down with one of my favorite people, Nick Coffin. He's, by the way, he's self-described also a great hang. He is a design leader who calls himself your human in the loop, which I absolutely love. Nick is a 25-year UX design veteran, founder of the San Francisco consultancy Gage, and has taught data narratives in CCA's design MBA program for quite some time. He's helped heavyweights like Adobe and Airbnb and Genentech turn messy human signals into product decisions, which is obviously a big deal. And as I mentioned before, he's not only a good hang, he's just good people all around, and I'm really excited to have him here. Welcome, Nick.
Hello, Justin. Thank you for having me. Always good to see your face.
Likewise, likewise. So I'm going to start at the very start, and we were just talking about this. I would love to hear your journey to becoming a design leader and doing what you do today, which I think is probably a bit different than where you started. You started at Alta Vista, which, you know, I think is like maybe the first search engine, if not one of the very, very like top two, three search engines out there, even before there was a Google. Tell us a little bit about your journey from IC visual designer to this badass design leader data guy that you are today.
Yeah, I'll give you some context, given I'm a father of two boys, both of whom are going through some formative phases in their lives about who they are and what they do and what they like doing. I was my younger son's age in an aftercare program where the den mom sat us all down with some pen and paper just to keep us quiet for a little while. At the time, I was interested in dog bites and World War II planes and aircraft and things like that. And this moment could have been as short as 15 to 20 minutes. I think about the actual visual piece that I worked on, and it wasn't this sort of opus. It was a very, just like a quick drawing. And I remember looking around the table and then looking at my stuff. It's like, wow, I really invest myself emotionally into this output. And I see all of my classmates, and they didn't care. They were sort of waiting for their apple juice and saltine crackers. And it was a formative moment for me of, you know, this isn't bad. I don't mind drawing. I don't mind the visual aspect of storytelling. And I like what I did, and I take pride and confidence in that what I did was really good. And there was another instance of that in college where, as a freshman, my very first college course at the University of Oregon, I talked my way into an upper graduate course where it was all juniors and upper level course where it was all juniors and seniors. And I just knocked the first assignment out of the park. And I remember, again, that emotional investment in that time spent of like, I will do this because I love doing it. I don't do it because I'm trying to get a good grade. I do this because I have an idea and a vision. I need to see it come to fruition. And that started me on that path. And fast forward to my first job out of college, coming back to the San Francisco Bay Area, I thought, oh, okay, there's this thing called the internet in 2000. And it's this conflux of visual art and technology. And there's not many places in the world like San Francisco that can encourage both sides of that coin. And I was just so fortunate to have that in my backyard, where as I was coming out of school was 98, and that these technology companies were seeing this rapid growth and explosion, and that it was in an area that I was versed in and that I was privileged enough to have technology as a kid, and parents who encouraged arts. And so I walked into Alta Vista, you know, with dreams of startup gold. As you had mentioned, these were days before Google. And my first project was to be the lead designer of this thing called Image Search, where Alta Vista had the ability to search Cindy Margolis and you bring up all images of a specific keyword. And, you know, that was is an exciting time because of the possibilities and the promise. But it was also very tumultuous in that when Google came out, Alta Vista became obsolete. And right. then in March of 2001, due to the Microsoft antitrust ruling in Europe, having to decouple the browser versus the operating system, there was a huge fall in the market. And then Alta Vista laid off, you know, 20% of their staff and never got to go public because their roadshow was happening during that crash. And so, you know, that was an early point for me to say, oh, you're unemployed now. You came home from college. You shared your parents this job offer who, in their early 60s, looked at their paycheck and then the paycheck you were getting and saying, you're making more money than I am. Yeah. And I'm in the last 5 years of my career. They're educators. Yeah. You know, they made good choices in their lives. But it was the beginning of this cycle of... Mm-hmm. Full-time employment, freelancing, consulting, contracting, full-time employment, startup, fail, startup, fail, startup, fail, and really figuring out that balance isn't standing still. Balance are these micro adjustments to the left and the right of who you are and what you do
right.
to accommodate for the shifting tides.
Right. I love those micro adjustments. You know, we talk a lot in our circles, in the same circles we live in and work in, and certainly in the design MBA about, you know, everything is a prototype, including you. Mm-hmm. And that feels very much like what those micro adjustments are. It's like you realizing even early on, and I'm sure there were feelings that went along with being laid off and not making a gazillion dollars. But having said that, right, these micro adjustments are really, oh, this realization, yeah, things change. I have to change with them. This is all a prototype, and so am I. Something like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's still happening, and it's it's healthy to have fear and excitement at the same time. I think Confucius said that those were the two emotions that you wanted to always accompany one another, is fear and excitement. And when you get laid off, be excited for what's next.
Yeah.
Be afraid of it. I'm afraid of this new technology. Am I going to lose my job? But I'm also excited to learn and figure out how it's going to do. And so, you know, I think that as designers, you know, that definition of where are we going to be with this, given that the field is rapidly changing around mm-hmm. us and mm-hmm. our proprietary workplace of design tools mm-hmm. and workflows are being challenged. To say that, no, you know, you design community have done this wonderful job over the last 10 years of systematic thinking, style guides, pattern libraries, component design, mm-hmm. and you've mm-hmm. shared this out in the world for our models to train themselves on. Mm. And now, because of that hard work that you've done, anybody with a few keystrokes can go assemble a carousel, a landing page, anything right. like that without your help, because you've proven it. That this is the way that we right. on this screen want to see the information. Early days of design, it was much more subjective, where Justin had a way of style and communication that Nick had a completely different interpretation of. But that's standardized and really narrowed to say, you know, all sites are going to look alike now.
Is it, you know, okay, that's a great debate to have too, right? There is, I would... literally just yesterday having a similar conversation with another design leader about this idea of, you know, he also has an agency and he and his co-founder are using Replit, right? So this is a bit of a vibe coding plus real coding tool. He's doing it mostly with the vibe coding version. And he's a designer at a design agency And he's like, yeah, well, we don't really have to design much because it's pulling in Tailwind libraries and other things that pretty much have all of those systems in it. And the conversation that we're having now here as well is, okay, you know, the pendulum has swung pretty far towards these design systems and perhaps away from this version of subjectivity, taste. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we talk a lot about taste in design as well.
Yeah.
Has it swung too far? You know, it has like this systems thinking or this, you know, this process Tailwind and all these other libraries and systems, have they sort of removed some of the originality from this? Where are we going?
Yeah, it's always been the artifact, right? Design has always been the end point. Everything building up to getting there, I think there is a lot of room for originality. And these are one of the core attributes of user experience, of design thinking, of facilitation, is that how do we ensure that that artifact is the right one? This won't be the last metaphor that I use during this conversation, but it will be the one that I draw back to, is that we've all been given these electric bicycles to say, hey, if you want to get to the end as fast as you can, boom, you're now working at a velocity and speed that is superhuman. That feeling of first time getting on a bike, especially the ones that aren't pedal assist, that you can hit the throttle down and go above 27 miles an hour. Those are this feeling of like, I can get from thought to artifact very quickly. Where design, and I'll go back to your early point of like that definition of that pendulum, starts to facilitate is that to ensure the direction that the bicycle goes in is the right one. It's to ensure that where we arrived meets all standards and meets all requirements. And those are things we've been doing for decades and years. It's not necessarily that artifact anymore. It's the facilitation in building up to that artifact to ensure that the direction and the velocity that we're going in lends itself to success. When you have the ability to speed through that last part of a product design lifecycle, do you allow yourself for more user-centered exploration at the beginning, or do you just try to go faster, faster, faster without any repercussions of, are we going the right way?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it sort of even begs the question, and this is a bit heady, but I ask everyone this a similar question, which is, what is design then, right? We're in 2025, I think, right? Yeah, we're 2025. What is design? What does design mean to you? You call yourself human in the loop, right? And I think understanding that not all design these days is even human. I mean, there's some human in there, but what is design and what is human in the loop then to you today?
Yeah. It goes into behavioral psychology more than ever. And you know, to keep throwing back references to how old I am, you know, UX.
Not as old as me, by the way. Not as old as me.
I don't know. We'll see. the advent of UX really came about with the introduction of mobile phones and Apple's notion of it just works. And UI was commoditized very quickly when Google Material Design and Project Kennedy said, you know, these interfaces that subjectively independent developers are putting on these devices, just follow the standard, the cookie cutter of here's what a button looks like and here's that. And Apple did the same thing. And these large vendors of devices and interfaces said, let's try to keep things looking like the value of the brand. At the same time, a overseas workforce through platforms like Guru or Upwork, or you could find somebody to do UI pretty easily. And so wireframes could then get turned into interfaces without that notion of subjectivity and quote art in air quotes. And so that user experience was a refreshing notion for, no longer were you really worried about what color the pixel were. You were trying to understand what emotions were drawn from going through a workflow or a process or an application. Right. And it goes back to your question of like, what is design? And if it's understanding of the emotion that the user has going through a process, yes, digital artifacts will stand up or frustrate people along the way, but where do you start to pull off those wow, aha, love moments where it's not something computers are very good at. They may be good at the UI, but they're not understanding the UX of where you can start to find those real differentiators of a service design, of a customer experience, of flow.
Yeah, I love that. This is the human piece. This is the, you know, I think what we've seen so far is AI is really good at reflecting things back to us that we will react positively to. But what I'm hearing and what I believe as well is that is not UX. UX is not always some positive response, right? Because, it often requires a little friction. It often requires a little zhuzhing or something else to elicit some bigger response to it or get us to do something, click something, understand something, be wowed, awed, whatever. I love that. I love the idea that it's emotion. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Little tweaks. I'll give you one that you know and then one that I'm working on myself. One you know is the first time you opened an Uber app and you saw all these taxis, which were fake, by the way, saying, go and find one. And when you're looking at a market that, A, people are worried about getting in the cars of people they don't know because the gig peer-to-peer economy was still new at the time, and B, don't know where those taxis are, to know, are these Ubers going to leave me standing on the curb just like that taxi cab? Is there still a value in the convenience of being an app-based versus a phone-based taxi hailing service? And by showing those little animations, oh, they're all around me. I'm not going to be waiting a long time. And look, everybody's riding in these things.
Right.
When it actually wasn't the car. But the UX of the first app experience of Uber was wonderful. That's one you know, and it's very common. The one that I'm working on is this service of which people need to see an artifact of an evidence of activity. Now, the system of which I'm designing will have activity on a daily basis, where at the end of the day, it'll tabulate everything. But the integration that the user goes through the first time they see this experience needs to show them that the activity is happening in real time because it's tracking and clocking. And so when they come into that, there'll be that Uber experience of once they hit authenticate and go, there's a counter that's happening and there's something that's running. Whereas really in the background, it will tabulate on a nightly basis just because the through rate or the rate limiting of calling external services all the time for every client, for every platform is not feasible. But to do that once a day at the end in the background is something that is going to be the reality. So it's making those nuances of, oh, it's really working. I pressed that button and I saw something awesome. I think those are the kinds of points of experience that algorithms don't necessarily know to stop and think about and consider. What would somebody feel like when they came into the room, or what would somebody feel like if they sat down at the table?
It makes a ton of sense. I mean, let's go a little deeper then. You know, what we're talking about here are humans studying humans and injecting emotion, designing for some emotional response, including the, great. I feel safe. I feel covered. There are Ubers, or I can understand, oh, great. The numbers are here. All I need to do is wait for these numbers, whatever that is. You know, I think you've warned against using this idea in AI of synthetic users to test, to study. What shouldn't be automated when we're using AI and we're looking for lots of data? I'm going to put it another way. A CEO comes in, you engage, right? Engage, you work with some giant companies. And a CEO says, hey, I want to also cut. I'm hiring Gage, but I also want to cut 80% of our research costs. What line do you draw? What shouldn't be automated? Where do you stand on that?
I'll give you the Airbnb scenario where one of their verticals wasn't performing very well. It was the private rooms, where private rooms were immune to regulation, because if you want somebody in your house, you're fine. But when you just empty the house and then try to put the house on the market, that's when homeowner associations and condo developers get a little worrisome. So they were seeing that flat line and people weren't renting rooms anymore. And the research staff, internal research staff, had a hypothesis of why. They had mm-hmm. several of them. And they had keywords that represented that hypothesis. One was kitchen access. The other one was sort of workers, people who are doing it for business. And so they were keywords that represented each of them. And our job was to go in and look at positivity and negativity as it related to reviews for private room stays. And to the tune of 40 million reviews that had either five stars of it was positive or less than five stars of maybe it wasn't positive.
Yeah.
And one can't go into 40 million reviews and just say, let me just pull some things out. You have to have an idea that's based upon some strategy that is through in-depth conversations. And through that, we were able to segment location and access and host and all of the hypotheses and start to see discrepancies between how people talked about their host in five-star reviews versus less than five-star reviews. And then from that, make recommendations to the host guidelines of, hey, make sure that you find common ground in different areas when somebody comes in and you have definitions of this, that, and the other. Give you just an example of that takeaway. But all that was predicated with these theories are coming from in-depth interviews with human beings versus mm-hmm. we just ran 40 million through an algorithm and ta-da, here's what it came up with. It's that A, that wouldn't have been possible given the variance of data, and B, that there was just a need to be able to relate it back to real human beings. And so you're hearing a theme coming up with is that importance of behavioral sciences as it relates to strategic design decisions. And I think that's where UI and UX really deviated, is that some fell in love with the craft and some fell in love with the pixel perfect and the systematic mm-hmm. thinking and the design. And some said, OK, well, let's go up the food chain a little bit and try to understand what it is we need to design it. You're familiar with the double diamond approach of making mm-hmm. sure you design things right. And that, I think that's going to be one of the core skills that people coming through the program, people coming into the job market, really need to adopt qualitative research skills, even basic understanding of data that comes out of them, survey design, things like that, where you're able to defend the need to talk to human beings, CEO. Mm-hmm. If you want to cut research costs in the transcription, like we're using a tool that will do that all for us, we can certainly improve our efficiency and improve our scale, but we can never substitute our process.
Yeah, it makes total sense. You know, I'm making an assumption here. You were handed 40 million, I think it was 40 million? 40 million reviews, that's a lot. You were handed 40 million reviews. How did you go about the quant part of that, right? You ran some surveys, you had real human insight from, and that created qual for you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I'm at Airbnb, I'm like, yeah, great, these are awesome quotes. I can see what you did with your survey. What happened with our 40 million reviews? You know, how do you chunk through those and then, you know, in the same breath, create some kind of quant that then matches what, you know, the qual is saying?
Yeah. The processing, it was always the hard part. Removing pronouns, names, keywords.
Yeah.
And then looking at it in dimensions that match the hypotheses. For hierarchy, when people would use location, their sentences would branch off to how they were using that word in the context of a string of text, much like a language model is supposed to try to mm-hmm. know which word comes next. We were doing the same thing with specific keywords to say, as we talk about the host or as we talk about the location or the kitchen or the pets or whatever, we're using these words with hierarchy and frequency. And you're able to see and branch different visualizations to say, when I compare how people talk about location in positive reviews versus negative reviews, you see these branches are much stronger because they're speaking positively about that keyword in this context and negatively or not so positive in that context. And so it's a way of quanting the qual. The same thing's true with sentiment analysis, where you can take those keywords or all keywords found in a subset of reviews by demographic. We removed all personally identifiable information, but we had, is it work or is it personal? Is it male or female or none of the above? Are they a super host or a one-time host? Like some basic comparisons of who was submitting the reviews, and then looking at frequency of use versus assessed sentiment, where if people were talking negatively about pets and these kinds of reviews, business owners would always talk about Wi-Fi, of it was the number one reason why I didn't like staying there is because they had shitty Wi-Fi. And you could see those keywords come up on especially mail, especially business reviews, of the thing that will lead to a bad stay is that the Wi-Fi wasn't great. So again, it's sort of ways of taking things that are normally imperceptible. The CEO and the knife cutting, you're never going to get somebody looking at 40 million reviews and tabulating them. And these are ways of processing data that we didn't have before. And now we're able to look at and hopefully go back into these conversation points with qualitative research to say, let's talk about your router and your mesh network and the things about what measures are you doing for that your guests feel like the Wi-Fi is good or bad.
Yeah. I feel like what's profound there and like how much things have changed. Here's a story of my own. Back in, this would have been 2009 to 2010, I was working at Autodesk, and you know, I had an AutoCAD product. So if anyone doesn't know what AutoCAD, it's basically the, you know, computer-aided design product that everyone uses that sort of started the whole thing with a UI that, you know, you can move lines and other things around. I am not an AutoCAD user. I was a senior product manager running a product that I really didn't know how to use. But I'm also a designer, and we were looking for ways to understand what were people really doing, what was their intent when they opened the product. And we had similarly millions and millions and millions of interactions because we had instrumented, this is desktop software. Yep. We'd instrumented every single click and button click and button and every and movement of the mouse and everything else. And we hired someone to do k-means clustering on it all to come up with generally speaking, you know, some people are just opening it to print something, some people are opening it to draft something, and some, you know, and here's five, seven other, I think we had seven, right? Here's five other personas sort of based on their general usage. That was a long time ago, and that's math. That's k-means clustering. It's just math. AI has come around, and what you're talking about is similar, except now I think we're talking about AI. I mean, I think what we're talking about is AI and natural language processing and stuff like that has changed the game, has turned this into something where, yes, you still do qual, and you're speaking with real humans. You're also, you know, then doing sentiment analysis on big, deep data sets. Is this requiring AI then to do a lot of this work? And then what is AI then shaving off some of the time? Is it doing work for you in ways that maybe I wasn't able to do before? I just would love you to qualify or quantify that for me.
Yeah. I think every time you come into a workflow, and the beautiful thing about design school, and by the way, I'm a CCA graduate as well as an instructor.
Yeah, love it.
And the thing that solidified, I mentioned a couple sort of very monumental moments in my career, design school or going to a design-centric program was not so much about the tools. It was really about the defensibility of the work. Standing up, we used to have foam core boards, 8x4 foot foam core boards, and the classes were put your work up, stand in front of it, talk about it, defend it. And that was a very hardening of steel, of like, okay, when you present visually, you better know what you did there. The worst thing you could say is, I don't know, or, you know, have no justification for why this was the way. The second aspect about it was that every art project was up to you of how you wanted to do it. And that was a wonderful, liberating part of my career where I can use any tool I want to, provided I get to the answer, the deliverable, the presentation. I've got one that just came across my desk this week. It's in a topic that I know very little about. And
that's my favorite kind of topic, by the way. Yeah.
It's working with a client who is all in and transferring time and wealth into a topic he cares very much about. And the wonderful role of the consultant is it's like a stand-up comedian who's doing improv versus a character actor who has to really understand what this character would do. As somebody who's an improvisational artist, they've got to make it up as best as they can. And so as a consultant, I need to go from 0 to 60 on a topic I know very little about. And my first step is to say, okay, let's train a language model. Go and get every article you can, every book you can, put it all in a PDF form and start to train a model on this topic. And so one of the asks or requests for my consultancy is data visualization, is articles that explain the data, is to start to become a publication platform for my client to then go and repurpose however they see fit. And, you know, okay, how would I do that 10 years ago? I would sit there and I would read for a week and try to like really get myself into some form of opinion or understanding of this topic. And now the last 3 days have been training a model by downloading 200 pieces of work from the web and beginning a conversation with what I'm hearing my client wants to go into this secondary aspect or this perspective. Where do you see? And oh, by the way, give me stats. Reference all of the statistics within these documents so then I can then show a visual, a data narrative around some of the topics that we're expanding upon. That's AI to me. It's like, you know, you need to get there. How would I do it normally? I would download the PDFs, put them into a folder on Google Drive, and just go and print them out and read them. Or instead of putting them in a folder, I'll put them in a language model and I'll start to train that model as to a conversation that I want to have more information about. So I you know, it goes back to the Airbnb example was in 2019. Odd time for us, but it was all open source models from most of them out of Stanford, those natural language tools. And it was before we started using that buzzword of AI and that notion of, you know, ability to process data in ways that we hadn't normally thought of before. It's been a good journey and very liberating to be able to make things up, much like art school, where, you know, that's not what the client asked for, but it's the way I want to think about this at scale and at speed.
What I'm hearing here is, really, as a, you know, as a forward-thinking designer, design leader, also tinkerer. I mean, this, you know, I think that's what a lot of people learn at CCA, whether it's in design or art, is exactly what you just said, which is make something that's meaningful to you, right? Piece this together with whatever materials make sense to give it form and shape. Whether that's some, you know, human experience through UI or a physical experience or digital, whatever it is. And I'm hearing that's, and I know this of you, right? That this is something that you just do, that you're quite adept at, is just grabbing these things and starting to mold and shape them for purpose. So here goes my next set of questions about that is, you know, we've got AI everywhere. And in fact, so much so, I mentioned before, you know, a CEO decides to, you know, reduce costs by saying, oh, we don't need all this research and so forth. And same thing, we're seeing, you know, UX departments being gutted, companies as well, but UX departments being gutted. If you now at Gage, and I think you do some of this, if you had to go build a 5 or 7 or 10 person design org from scratch, what roles would stay, what roles would sort of like, I don't really need that specialized thing anymore. What new roles appear out of nowhere?
Yeah. I heard a comment last night about instead of organizations being triangle shaped, they now become diamond shaped, where there's going to be this cross pollination. If anybody can do anything, meaning Justin, as an engineer, you can go into Cursor and generate UIs, or as a product manager, you can do the same thing, or as a designer, I can start generating product specs. If now there's ubiquity in our formal silos to say we should all be in the same pool together, how do you respect or adhere to a traditional structure of an organization? Designers design. If you have a code component, run it through the design review process. They'll review it, make revisions, submit it to engineering. Engineering will then develop in code, and then that's how we get things done. Whereas now, we've got the efficiency not to have to go through that manual anymore, is that we can reference things that are known to iterate on them much more quickly. So my 10-person organization as a design org, it's going to mandate that there are those who, from a design operations perspective, are now writing rules for algorithms. They're the ones that are being the prompt engineers. You mentioned tools like Replit, and I don't want to go too technical too quickly, but the vibe coding platforms that will be the most valuable are the ones where you can establish guardrails and then you constrain what it's doing, because like any good politician, they'll give you the answer that you think you want to hear as fast as possible, because oh my gosh, and maybe for 80% of the time that's a great answer. But to be able to constrain maintain an environment in which the work that your organization or your department does will find valuable, I think is the shifting role of design operations, where, all right, these are the libraries, these are the packages, these are the reference, this is the style, same way that they would maintain a pattern library or a departmental workflow. The designers that took the red pill and learned how to code are now...
I like that that's the red pill, by the way. That makes sense. Yeah.
If they have a context and an understanding that's going to be increasingly valuable. Yeah. And same thing with the front-end engineers that can take the time to listen to user feedback and iteration. I think that design thinking... you talked about the pendulum, and just internally in my own perceptions and experience, I for a few years just thought it was like, so overblown and hyped. And I saw value in it initially, but let's just build things. Let's just get to it. Let's stop with the sticky notes. Let's just start. Let's try and fail. Let's prototype it out. And now I've gone completely the opposite direction, where there's going to be such value in that workshop and planning and coordination and scheduling to say, like, these are skills of cross-modal teams that are going to be so valuable. And there's nobody better to do that than design practitioners to really understand where our roles lie and what the reasoning is and what jobs need to be done. And so I would make sure that somebody within that design organization has that facilitation responsibility. That addressed a little bit of your questions about, so what's coming from scratch, what roles are extremely important, and which new roles appear. Example I mentioned just a minute ago about the aggregation of a knowledge base for a new area of study, that's a junior level job. You need to go index, tag, make sure you cite the article so that any algorithms that are being referencing it have proper attribution. And it's a research assistant, and that can be applicable for whatever field or discipline that you're in. And I encourage that retraining of, instead of just going and assuming that the algorithm is the expert, is to really understand and share out, here's how you got to this point.
Yeah. It makes total sense. I like this, and I think this idea of, it's really this evolution and blending of skills, and you mentioned like the taking the red pill and learning how to code. You You told me a story the other day, and I'm not going to tell you who the client. You can decide if you want to say who the client is. But you told me a story that was like, this was like the mind-blowing thing to me, which was so here I am. I've worked in big orgs for a long time, and I've also been a consultant for a long time. And, you know, there has for a very long time been this, I don't know, it's like this headiness of the design org and also the headiness of the engineering org and product sort of, you know, pulling the strings and handoffs, right? And so, you know, here at Autodesk, I had a 200-person engineering team. And in that engineering team were also, you know, designers. So not all 200 were engineers. They were all different kinds in QA, but also a bunch of designers. And everyone had their remit, right? Everyone knew what they were doing. And then there were lots of handoffs between things. And the story you told, I'm just going to paraphrase, is you were working for a big org and that you worked with a bunch. And, you know, and the normal way to work would have been design, build Figma files, hand off to engineering product, and they run with it and do with what they will with those files. And you said, nah, we're not doing that. We're not going to use the prototyping tools in Figma to build clickable prototype. We're just going to build the thing using the actual code libraries. And I think you were using Cursor, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were using Cursor, and basically you've vibe coded or partially vibe coded plus a little bit of extra coding what is real. And on one side you had the design team sort of tearing their hair out, and on the other side you had the engineering or product team going, oh my god, this is exactly what we've been wanting and asking for, is something real that we can then instrument or plumb or whatever it is. All right, so there it is. What's maybe fill in the gaps for me, and what's the moral of that story when we're talking about designers now who can use vibe coding tools, which also then code? And maybe this is also, you know, designers who can code.
Yeah.
What's the moral of that story?
The person in the story was the junior designer who was their first job out of college, CCA grad in interaction design. And they had been spending the last 4 years of their academic career in Figma, preparing for a workplace, a graduation time in which the world would accept her to say, you are so skilled. You know, we know you know it all. Like, you're so good at this. Now go and get it and put these skills to use. I apologized to her several times along the way, because like within 2 weeks of coming onto this 6-month engagement, I was like, we can't use this tool anymore because are a returning engagement with a client that we failed last time. And the failure was in that we delivered the end all be all Figma deliverable to a team that didn't have the budget, the priority, the resources, the capability to implement it. So as an architect, we built a house that was going to fall over. And unfortunately, we came back in and we saw the mess that was made of our last deliverable. And so I communicated to this young designers that we're not going to make that same mistake twice. We're going to go headlong into some of these generative tools. I take exception with vibe coding. I think that term suggests a looseness of interpretation and abstraction. This is coming from a bleach blonde Californian. Like, the vibe is always like so casual. Whereas I think we need to be very distinct.
Right
about
on, work. Right on, dude. Yeah.
Bro, like, bro, you're bro, harsh. You're harsh. You're harsh in my vibe in your COVID. So we went through, what we needed to do was provide the development team who would be receiving this deliverable in 6 months' time with as small of a gap as possible. And Figma is wonderful in many things, but in terms of an output of a code base or even a prototype, it doesn't feel like the web. It feels like an image map, you know, like the InVisions and the it's horrible. And so from a user testing standpoint, how can you really simulate the complex interaction that some of these web experiences have when it's really,
if you can only click here, then then what's the choice? Yeah, you can only click there.
Yeah. I want to see the mess. So we tried UXPin. We tried Dreplet and Lovable and Bolt and on and on and on and on. V0. We tried all of these vibe coding tools, but it never got us to the code base. And we wanted to work with the code components that were already built so that the development team didn't have to do anything new unless we explicitly said, hey, there's some part of the UX that we could really use this. Now, in a traditional organization with siloed departments, you would design something, you would submit it for review, it would go into the queue, and on Thursdays at 2 p.m., they would review it. They would decide whether or not you want to send it back for revisions, or they would put it in the queue for the development team, who is overtaxed to begin with, to eventually get to integrate into Storybook and their 1.14 version of React and Tailwind and whatever it might be. By having access to the code component library by way of our internal email addresses and the GitHub repository that contained them, we could train a model to say, here are the libraries, don't install any third party, lock down your package.json, and then any UI that, in this case, Cursor, would generate has to follow the standards and the syntax and live within this world. And it reduces the abstraction of designer's deliverable, because now you are developing in an environment that is as close as possible, the one that the engineering team will be implementing. And all the logic and variables and conditions and workflows and experiences that you're authenticating saves them from having to do all of that. We used Google Sheets as an integration so that in this case, it was like a 10-step form that internal users at this company had to fill out. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be responsible about the data that we're using. So each of the 10 steps was a different tab in a Google Sheet using a unique identifier and making sure that we were mapping all the fields correctly and that we were treating the data and understanding where it fell over and where it exceeded boundaries. And so that understanding of the quantitative aspect of data governance, bringing into your prototype and your application. And the joke about the word prototype was it gives you this leash or this, excuse is too hard of a word. It gives you this, this air of temporalness that allows for a lot of interpretation where, it's just a prototype. Like that's
a throwaway.
It's just a throwaway. Oh, by the way, I'll cut to the end of what I thought was a training exercise, but turned out to be a handoff. You know, I was very eager to go and train the design department of, at this company, this is possible. This is what you can do if you put down Figma. And it was with a VP of design who had come from a brand and marketing background. So the portfolio looked great, but the understanding of product was not great. And the VP of product, who had been there forever and brought us in to really start to think about, and was also responsible for all the internal tools. And then their number twos and threes underneath them in their various departments. And so the presentation was walking through this application and the requirements and the data that stood it up. I didn't talk much about Cursor or the way that we got there, because that would have gotten a distraction on how did you make the thing do the thing, but it was really more about the how can you get to that end point. And the product team was just smiling and laughing, and the design team was just scratching their heads of like, where's the Figma in all of this? It's like, no, we're going from the requirements, and then we're using the library components, and then we're authoring the prototypes from there. And like we're trying to get it to as close as possible to a deliverable. You can call it a prototype if you want to, but the developers is whose time we're trying to save. And so that was a very pivotal project for us, for me. It's rethought, it's challenged my thinking about what does the design leader need to know. You asked the question about your organization. How do we retrain our staff? How do we accommodate for everybody's in the swimming pool now? And you know, how do we find the definition of what design does? Because it's being challenged now in ways that we haven't seen yet. So those are things that I'm processing.
This was an aha moment for me. It was pretty profound, and it is still when you tell it to me that way, which is, we're not using Figma. Well, where's the?
Yeah,
we're creating the thing so the handoff is smoother, so that we're lessening the time to actually get this thing into some mode that production, right? Even if it's a dev, you know, mode that we can continue to test.
Yeah,
it's big. You know, I think then I've got two questions behind that. I'm looking at time, so we're close. One question is, so you know, here you had design leader on that side, and you know, and his teams, and he doesn't come from that, he comes from brand, so that makes sense that he's also, you know, he's hired people who are supposed to be shepherding this through with a certain process perhaps. But you've got this design leader, you've got mid-career design, you know, leaders, managers, and so forth. What should they do with that? What should they take away from that story? Again, it's kind of the moral of the story. What would you say to them now? I mean, you kind of said it, like, there's no Figma here. Yeah. What should they do so they don't lose their job? wholesale gone with that. What should they be doing?
Yeah, when the lingua franca becomes extinct, who do you talk to? Find somebody within your organization that can help guide you through that process, whether that be establishing a formal mentorship program with maybe the engineering tools, that engineering team that have been given keys to this engine as design. Maybe you use it in demos and hackathons, but you don't get to use it in production workflow. But there is somebody within your organization that are using these tools. Like, hey, that's a relationship between, I know for years, we as designers have been constrained in the resources that we can offer you. The tables have turned. It's like, now we need engineers to pair with. And in all honesty, Justin, that story is only possible because I took 20% of our budget for that project and I spent it on a front-end engineer behind the scenes who made sure that the version control was correct, that the package.json was the way it needed to be, who made sure that that front-end environment for that the deliverable was in a place that it needed to be. So it lends itself to collaboration more now than ever. And I think that can be comfortable for some people and that can be uncomfortable. Finding those superpower buddies, the Justice League of design and development is going to be a mandate for design leaders to say, talk to product and say, hey, in order to facilitate you better, we're going to need to pair. And that the outcome can be, so going back to those notions of pair design, you know, that I think those are things that have persisted.
Yeah, I that's great. I mean, here we, you know, also it's been decades that we're talking about, it was paired coding, right? Mm-hmm. So one person sitting over the shoulder of another person, and actually increased the efficiency of just writing code.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it because here's one, you know, a backseat driver, but it turns out, no, it actually it created better efficiencies in creating better code. And it sounds like something very similar, which is there, no more throwing something over the wall to someone and then having a handover, handoff, having arguments about what can and can't be done.
Yeah.
No, you can create. That's big. Almost last question. Okay, so let's go all the way back to Alta Vista and just prior to Alta Vista. You're in your early 20s, 21, 22, whatever it is. You're entering design. You know that this is something you want to do. What's the learning plan that you would follow, that you'd give yourself? You know, courses, subject material, metrics. What are you telling yourself to go learn?
Yeah, I would try and fail as much and as fast as possible. It's nice if it's a paid gig. But to one of the things that I consider a benefit of being in a startup scene is that if you want that work experience to come fast and at a very quick cadence, startups try, fail, startup, try, fail, start, and see what you can get off the ground. I had a conversation with somebody about the rungs of a ladder. where, you know, how do you go from junior to mid to senior to director? Mm-hmm. And that, what does AI do with that? And we talked about organizational structure shapes and things like that, but there's no reason that with these acquired skills of a learning plan is that somebody can't put on a jetpack and jetpack to the roof rather than take the ladder.
Yeah.
So that 3-year plan would be to A, expose myself to as many different progressive work environments that is going to reject some of the larger companies who aren't moving as fast as they would like, but go into some of the startups who will be more chaotic and more stressful, but you're going to iterate faster. And to courses, I think Maven is wonderful. There's a series of lightning talks where you can just go and hear somebody talk for an hour about their workflow and their concept. That's a great sort of side conversation to have when you're doing work that may be a little bit more tedious. And side projects are the curiosity of, you know, I'm interested. I want to tinker. I want to see where the boundaries of my knowledge can be pushed a little bit more. From a metric standpoint, I've always troubled myself with scale, where I feel like if there's something I can scale up, whether it be a Discord community or number of participants, or there's a notion of, yeah, you can do it once, but can you do it at a scale that is perceivable? That's always a challenge for me, is not to be niche or boutique or bespoke, but to say, no, it's not just this one off. It's something that can be replicated out. That's my 22-year-old playbook, 3-year learning plan.
Yeah, that would be mine too. Yeah. Try everything, prototype everything, fail a bunch, you know, hopefully in safe places to fail, but perhaps not so safe too. Works quite well. Yeah.
Justin, what was the impetus for getting out of enterprises like Oracle or Autodesk? What was the inner voice that said, I got to get out of this?
Learning. I love learning. This is why I mentioned as well, you know, I love being handed a problem, a project that I know nothing about. I know nothing about the industry. When I started consulting, I would tell people, you know, it didn't matter if it was healthcare, banking, auto, you know, I did them all. And someone would, you know, they'd be talking internally and there'd be an acronym. What is that acronym? Tell me what it means. I have one. I was working with a very large medical device company that was doing a strategic partnership, moving towards an acquisition of another startup in the same space. And I can't tell you who, but they were talking about, they kept talking about PNB, PNB. And I don't come from that. And I said, hey, stop, let's just stop. But we were using Post-its and there was big room executives. Stop. Said, what's PNB? This seems interesting and certainly really important to this deal that you're doing. It's called peripheral nerve blocks. I said, okay, well, we got to take 10 minutes now because you need to discuss and tell me, because this is fascinating. This isn't for you. This is for me.
Yeah.
And that's what got me into it. I love learning. That's why I love talking to you too. I love learning. I love the acronyms. I love the problems that we face and, you know, figuring out ways to best those problems or not, just knowing that they're there, you know, that someday that will be solved. That's what I love.
Yeah. Oh.
Thanks for asking. Nick, we're at time. What should people know about you? How should they connect with you? What are the things would you want to say to anyone here in this little audience, mostly design and design strategy and so forth?
Yeah, I think that as you and I are advanced in our careers and in positions of leadership ourselves, that we owe it to the younger generation. You do a wonderful job in your chairing of a department that trains designers, a young mid-level career. And I would encourage anybody that's listening to this podcast to be curious about the CCA Design Strategy Program. I have an investment as well to take what I heard from that last project where we challenged the notion of design and product and development. And said, I don't want to leave these people behind. These are my people. I've been on that side my entire career. So how do we help them? And I mentioned Maven. I mentioned coursework and training. I've launched something called a AI readiness assessment for design teams, for UX and design teams, to help understand the profile. Amazing. It will be publicly shared, the results. And you can find that at Retrain, that's R-E-T-R-A-I-N, .gage.io, retrain.gage.io. And so that is an assessment for you to figure out where your organization might be in comparison to those of similar size, of those of similar industries, and start to pull out some of the findings of, here are the blockers in place, here are some of the advantages that you might see, and with the hopes that we can start some reskilling of designers that are not going to be in Figma for much longer, or some UX research teams that are trying to see the efficiencies of these new skills. And so that's my hope, is to try to continue the conversation and the evolution of design as a field, as a curriculum, and as a community.
Beautiful. And can they reach you at gage.io as well?
Absolutely.
I imagine so.
Yep.
And LinkedIn. I see you there all the time, and I follow everything you say, and I usually give you a like too, because it's all interesting and we have great conversations.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Nick, for taking the time. We went over, and I never try to do that, but it's because it's fascinating, and you're fascinating, and I love the stories, and I appreciate you and you giving your time here.
Thanks for the kind words, Justin.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Design Shift. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a quick rating or review. It really helps more designers like you find the show, and it helps me make better shows. And if you're not already subscribed to our awesome newsletter, head over to designshift.me. See you next time.